supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, whether it's a broken bone or the pain of a broken heart or a broken life, trauma changes us. And despite how it might feel at the time, it doesn't always change us for the worse. Many people who suffer trauma report that their lives have actually changed for the better. The open wound, they say, opens their eyes to what's truly important in life. The scars left behind leave lessons in love, life, and possibilities. Healing from a wound, we all know, is never easy. Resilience requires more than a Band-Aid, a box of tissues, or the balm of time. But what is resilience really, and how do we find it? Well, we know some comes from within, but without others' care and compassion and support, most of us couldn't pull through. Joining me today is Dr. Froma Walsh. She's a clinical psychologist, a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, and among other things, she has authored Strengthening Family Resilience. Froma, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be part of your presentation today.
I'm also joined on the telephone by Rob and Robbie Wonder. Robbie became a quadriplegic 3 years ago as a result of a diving accident. His father gave up his job to live in Robbie's dormitory room with him to help Robbie get through college. Later on, we'll hear from Liz Scott. Liz and her husband lost their daughter, Alex, to cancer 5 years ago. But before she died, Alex wanted to sell lemonade to raise money to help doctors cure kids with cancer. That was the beginning of Alex's lemonade stand. We'll hear from Liz Scott in just a few minutes, and hopefully we'll hear from you also. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Froma, let's start with you. Most people, when they think about resilience, they assume that people who experience great adversity just pretty quickly get back to their old lives.
I think that's one of the myths about resilience, this idea of just bounce back, go back to normal, almost as if it didn't happen. But as we know, with tragedy or trauma, life is not the same. It changes our world as it changes us. I like to think of it better as bounce forward, that we have to adjust and adapt to a new normal. That's really what resilience is about. It's what we do with the bad things that happen to us in life.
Yeah, in a way, it doesn't happen until we give up trying to find what we had yesterday or trying to reclaim what was.
That's right. That's right.
Robbie, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So your story begins in July of 2006 when you broke your neck diving. The result of your paralysis, as I read about it, Robbie, is exactly where mine is, just below the collarbone.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. So this is a couple of months before your 17th birthday. Do you remember your earliest reactions when you knew what happened to you?
Well, I knew it happened right away. I didn't get, I wasn't knocked unconscious or anything, so, within 10 seconds I knew that I was paralyzed, because I went to stand up after I hit my head and I just couldn't move.
So what was the reaction in those first minutes, even those first weeks?
In the first minutes? I'm not sure. I guess it was just shock.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to like I wasn't really thinking too far into the future. I thought I'd just hit my head, but I mean.
And what about in the first weeks when you realized what all this meant?
Well, I mean, I guess like in the, for the first like few months, I just assumed that like I would get better.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
My like spirits were always so high just because I always just thought like, oh yeah, like I'm definitely going to get better. Like, I'm not going to be like this forever.
So in a way that did get you through the first few months.
Oh, absolutely.
let me turn to your father. Rob, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So tell us your reaction when you first heard. I mean, you were, well, at the time you were a teacher of handicapped children. So
yeah,
you had a deeper understanding about what all of this meant.
Well, I think Rob hit the nail on the head when he said we thought he was going to get better. You know, it's just, we figured, okay, well, you know, this happened, and then, you know, kind of, I guess there was a little bit of a denial maybe that it happened, and we were trying to figure it out, and it was, oh, well, he's going to get better. And then after a little while, it sunk in. It was like, woo, you know, and it was just, you know, it's something you always, it happens to somebody else. It never happens to you or your family or anything like that. It's just, you know, you can never prepare yourself in a million years for something like that, you know?
Let me ask you to focus on one breath you just made when you said, after you realize it's whoosh. So tell us about that whoosh.
He went from, you know, here in Cape May Courthouse to Atlantic City Trauma, and then from there he went to Jefferson where he had his surgery. And after Jefferson, he went to McGee Hospital, and we were getting off the elevator, and when we were taking him to his room, it was just he and I, and the elevator door opened up, and the first person we saw, the fellow was operating his wheelchair with his mouth. And at the time, we knew Rob had some movement and everything, and I just kind of thought, wow, you know, let's be thankful for what we have, and not, let's keep moving on. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, I guess we kind of felt sorry for ourselves after it happened, and then we said, well, we're going to make something happen out of this. We're not going to dwell on the past, because there's nothing we could do about the past. You know, just drop the luggage and let's keep moving.
Robbie, I want to read a journal entry you dictated to your mother in August. This is 1 month after your injury. And I'll quote you here. I just want to thank everyone for all the cards, gifts, prayers, messages, and donations. It means a lot that everyone has been going out of their way to do things, especially for me. When I got injured, I never thought in 1,000 years that I'd have this many people holding me up. Your love and support is what keeps me going. When I get down and look around the room, all the cards you've given me gives me the hope and knowledge that I will walk out of here. Thanks a lot, everyone. Love, Robbie. After reading this, one might think that you never felt any grief or anger or self-pity.
Well, I didn't at that point. I mean, like, up to that point, I was just like, I still thought that I was going to get better.
So what happened when you realized that you would not?
No, I guess by the time I realized that it wasn't, that I wasn't going to get any better, that I was already came to terms with the fact that, like, this is my life now. Because, I mean, after you have a spinal cord injury, they tell you you have about 2 years to get anything back. So, I mean, after 2 years of living this way, I was just kind of like, all right, well, I guess this is it. So
you felt no sadness or grief, anger?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like there was a surge of it. I mean, it comes at in phases, but then I just get over it.
Rob, tell us when and how you decided to leave your job.
It came down to we started looking at schools for Rob, and he chose to go to Temple, and we started looking into getting some help for, you know, a caretaker. And our insurance and everything said he wasn't eligible to have a round-the-clock caretaker. So we said, you know, even if we could pay for one, even with us both working, we still couldn't afford it. You know, it's very expensive for round-the-clock caretaker.
P.S., you just put in a plug for disability insurance that we should all have.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Go on. That's my political issue.
Go on. Yeah, but, you know, they said he was entitled to, like, 30, 35 hours a week, and we were like, well, that really doesn't do us any good. You know, so we talked about it, and you know, I had been a teacher for 22 years, and I was kind of getting to the end of my the end of my rope, maybe. But Sue said, you know what? Why don't you retire and you go with Rob? And it was like, well, okay, you know, we'll make it work, and that's what we did.
So. Did you have any second thoughts about it?
No. I mean, what was the alternative going to be? You can't go to college because we can't afford a caretaker for you? I mean, that wasn't going to happen. I mean, you know, Robbie can probably tell you the statistic about the amount of people with quadriplegics that are, you know, unemployed or, you know, I'm sure a lot of that has to do with the level of their injury and stuff like that. But, you know, Robbie said, well, you know, I'm not going to be, down in our area down here, there's really not a lot of, you know, you know, your fishermen or carpenters or, you know, and, you know, nothing wrong with that. But Rob's like, you know, I can't do any of those things, so I'm going to have to go to college. So, you know, we said, you know what, you and I both went to college. Our whole families have all gone to college. So we, you know, we realize the importance of an education.
What was your daughter's reaction?
Oh, she was tough. I mean, from day one, you know, she's been pulling for her big brother since day one. I mean, you know, it hit her hard, but she, you know, we have our community and our family and our friends have just pulled together for all of us. You know, taking Haley places and doing things for not only for Rob but for me, Sue, and Haley. You know, it's a wonderful thing. It really is.
I want to ask you now. We know the two of you live in one, I assume, small dormitory room. if this is too embarrassing, I guess especially for you, Robbie, you don't have to talk about it. But I would like our audience to hear what it takes in the morning to get you, Robbie, from bed into your wheelchair and to class.
Well, my dad basically just gets me up and helps me get a shower. Like, I have, like, a lift. It's basically just, like, a piece of fabric that goes underneath me. And he picks me up with that and puts me into a shower chair and helps me get showered. And then he helps me get dressed. And then he puts me in my power wheelchair and then gives me something to eat. And I go off to class.
How long does all of that take?
I guess about an hour and a half.
Yeah, and that doesn't address the more delicate issues that you and I deal with about bowel and bladder care, which adds extended time onto that.
Yeah.
And how about during the day? What kind of needs do you have?
I'm pretty self-sufficient. I mean, I need help getting things. If I need my computer, my dad needs to get it for me. But once I have it, I can use it. Or I need help, getting food, but once I have the food, I can eat it, all that kind of stuff.
Rob, what do you do when Robbie's in class?
Well, like you said, you know, the morning routine's pretty set. We get up, he gets showered and shaved and breakfast and dressed and all that kind of stuff, and then I take him to class, and then I usually go back and straighten up the room or, you know, any legwork that has to be done. You know, if we need anything, I'll take care of it then. Then I just drop him off at class. Give him his computer, and then I take off. During the day, I'm just kind of there being his hands. You know, I try to stay out of the way.
What's all this like for you, Rob?
It's an experience. You know, I'm at Temple for the second time because I graduated from Temple. So, and it's changed. Temple's changed a lot since I was there, and it's really, you know, it's a neat experience.
When you look at your life and your future, short term and long term, what's this like for you, laying on the floor caring for your son?
I wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, you know, it's what we do. I mean, it's, you know, we're taking it all in stride. We just have to we're making things happen as best we can. You know, and I mean, like I said, what was the alternative? Rob, you can't go to college because we can't afford somebody to be there with you?
Although I do want to challenge you on something.
Go ahead.
That you said in the Inquirer article.
Okay.
Here's a quote. You said, "This is nothing anybody else wouldn't do for their kids." And
I would hope it would be that way.
It's not. That's not completely true. There are many who would say their kids can't go to college. There are many who would focus on other issues. You have gone to extreme that others would not have. And I think this might be uncomfortable for you, but I think this says something about you, either your upbringing, your family values, even your genetics. But
you know what, Dan? Both our families are just, we both have really strong families, Sue's family and my family. And, you know, it's just the way we were brought up. I mean, it's just this is what you do. You know what I mean? I didn't really have any other thoughts about it. I mean, you know, I want Rob to be as successful as he can. I mean, if somebody else wouldn't do that, that's there's nothing really I can do about that. But I would just hope that if this opportunity was presented to somebody, that they would do the exact same thing.
And tell us, Rob, about your wife and what role she plays during all this.
She's here at home. Her and Haley, they're here during the week, and you know, she's still working and teaching, and you know, we come home on the weekends. Rob set his classes up so we have like 3-day weekends, which works out pretty good, and you know, we're just, you know, we talk sometimes in the morning, or you know, sometimes in the afternoon, and we'll talk at night, and you know, it's just
You accommodate. I want to turn to Froma. You have said that resilience is fostered through strong supportive connections. I wonder, doesn't something have to be there first? You know, a kind of inner strength. I hate the word strength. An attitude, a sense of hope, possibility.
I think it's both. The early research on resilience took the attitude that we have in our culture of the rugged individual, and looked for all of the keys to resilience as personality traits or character traits. And certainly, we do have something in our disposition, but it's also nurtured and supported by our loved ones, by our community, by our extended families. All of the studies on resilience found that the individuals didn't do it alone. Sometimes individuals have to do it alone when there is no one else, but I think what we're hearing here is how important a strong family can be.
I want to clarify the issue of supportive connections. As I implied earlier on in the show, I too am a quadriplegic. And early on, when people told me, you know, things would get better, I wouldn't always be ill or suffering or whatever, that felt the opposite of support to me.
That's right.
It felt like people telling me how I should feel. So what is support?
That's right. I think we have to look at resilience as a journey over time. And I think, as Rob said, you know, at first he held out strong hope that he was going to recover. And so when people sent their love and support and encouragement, it was really for him about recovery. And then, off and on our journey, we find that our hopes are dashed. And then we have to adjust to that so that support and hope may change in terms of what can be our best hopes and our best possibilities. And I think that's where we really dig down more deeply into ourselves and turn to others who will support our best potential.
Yeah, I think that's critical. I have said that when I'm in a dark hole, I want people who love me enough to climb in there with me and sit there rather than stand on the other side.
And, you know, I think in our culture there are two things. One is we shouldn't be dependent on other people. And most cultures around the world recognize the value of interdependence, that we're stronger when we can turn to one another. And that, as Rob's father said, he wouldn't have it any other way. This gives his life meaning, and doing this for his son is what is important.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about giving one's life meaning. Let me ask you one last question before we go to our break. What if family's not available or family's not supportive? Trust we can get that support from elsewhere.
I think we've seen in our society tremendous change in families. So it's who do we turn to? How do we find resources? For many, it may be a companion animal. It may be a pet, pets who are there with them, widows, people who are living alone. Give them important strength. And for most people, it's their personal faith, however they find that faith through God, a religious community, and through nature or loved ones.
That's going to be a topic I certainly want to address with all of my guests when we come back, and that's the issue of faith. Well, we're going to have to take a short break now. Robbie, you stick with us.
Yes.
But when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Liz Scott. Liz and her husband lost their daughter, Alex, to cancer 5 years ago. And as a result of her life and her death, they have founded Alex's Lemonade Stand, which has made fortunes of money for cancer research. We'll be talking with her after our break. We'll also talk more with Froma Walsh, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago and author of Strengthening Family Resilience. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Cooper University Hospital's Heart Institute is a proud supporter of WHYY, the only academic medical center in southern New Jersey. Cooper Heart Institute provides a full range of advanced cardiovascular care, from cardiac surgery to comprehensive testing and treatment from outpatient centers located throughout South Jersey. Details about Cooper Heart Institute programs and services are available at 1-800-8-COOPER or online at cooperheart.org.
This one goes out to the man who minds for miracles. This
on the next Fresh Air, The Circle. John Bon Jovi's got a new album. He'll tell us how he got his first big break by convincing a New Jersey DJ to play his music before he had a record deal or even a band. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Walking beside the guilty and the innocent. How will you raise your hand?
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the resilience of the human spirit. What is it? What is resilience? How do we heal? And why is it that some people, after life-altering trauma, seem to do better, thrive in many respects, despite the pain, and others seem to stay stuck? We heard earlier from Rob and Robbie Wonder. We're going to hear more from them after our next break. We've got on the line Froma Walsh, who's the author of Strengthening Family Resilience. But now we're going to be talking with Liz Scott. Alexandra, Alex Scott, was born almost 11 years ago, shortly before her first birthday. She was diagnosed with neuroblastoma and was informed by her doctors, or her parents were, that chances of recovery were doubtful. She received a stem cell transplant around her fourth birthday and initially felt better. So she told her mother that when she got out of the hospital, she wanted to start a lemonade stand so she could give money to the doctors to help them find a cure. Her first lemonade stand raised $2,000. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm always interested in people's hardwiring, you know, what we bring when we're born. So I want to know about Alex and the kind of baby, toddler she was, something about her character, personality.
I would say she was always very strong-willed from the day she was born. She was born early but went home right away, was pretty cranky baby when she didn't get what she wanted, just had this spark and this sense of being driven for whatever purpose, whether it was something selfish or, as it turns out, something to help other people.
early on, she went through, I don't even recall how many major surgeries, too many.
She went through 6 major surgeries. Yeah. After her first surgery, she was, we were told she was paralyzed from the chest down. And we were told, but give it a couple of years. And she did recover partial, but she always had paralysis. And as you talk about, you know, delicate issues of bladder and bowel, and yeah, she didn't have sensation in her leg. So not only did she have the cancer, but she had a lot of other obstacles along the road.
What was she like after the pain and suffering started? What was she like then, her personality?
I feel her personality was always, as I said, very resilient and very caring for others. She was very reserved in many ways. She was not a outgoing, very loud person, but she had a very commanding way about her. I would say over the years, she evolved really to a level of maturity towards the end of her life that you would compare to an older woman who was near the end of her life with a certain kind of wisdom and outlook that at the time I appreciated, but not as much as I appreciate it now looking back.
So when this happens to any family, it's an emotional roller coaster. It has to be. But this is happening with a child who's not only tenacious, but she's visionary in a way. I've got a question that's unanswerable, and that is, what was all this like for you and your husband? And you're not just talking about life and death, you're talking about a child who's a visionary here.
It was a roller coaster is a word I use a lot. It was, when you're living in it, and we have 3 other children, and you're busy and working and trying to care for Alex, you don't think about it so much. So it was really getting through the day, oftentimes. The fact that she was a visionary was something, that I think struck me more after her death than when she was alive. She was just Alex, and she had lots of big ideas to help other people and big ideas about what she could do when she grew up. And she was just really full of life and love, and she was our daughter. So it wasn't...
Right. Silly me, of course.
It wasn't about having a visionary for a daughter. It was about navigating through life as everybody does when things come their way, and you have to just deal with what's happening that day.
I'm being selfish here, Liz. I've got to give out the phone numbers and invite callers. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have been through trauma, you were a loved one, and feel you have grown as a result, give us a call. Or if you've been through trauma and feel you are stuck, if this kind of conversation bothers you, and I know it does many people, give us a call, 888-477-9499. We would love to hear from you. I want to come back, Liz, and I'd like to hear about your marriage. For better or worse, this kind of thing changes marriage dramatically.
It absolutely changes. I mean, my husband and I dated since high school. We went to college together. We owned a business together. We were building a life together. And in our minds, and I think I can speak for him, I usually try to, there was never a question that our marriage was not going to survive. It was truly, and it still is, for better or for worse. But fortunately, through the process, our marriage only grew stronger. And we learned to rely on each other for support. And it really drew us closer as we tried to raise our family and make sure that our kids were taken care of and felt equally loved.
You were living with life and death at the same time. Your child was living and your child was slipping away at the same time. What did you and your husband, how did you navigate those waters? What did you tell the boys?
The boys, that was actually the most challenging part. I mean, we knew for a long time she wouldn't survive. We knew for a good period of time that she was slipping away. The boys, however, were young, and we were very guarded with what we told them. I think I very much took the approach that you can't possibly be prepared for losing a sibling or a child. So,
how old were they?
Our oldest was not 9, going on 10, and the younger was the youngest was a toddler, and our middle child was 5, almost 6.
And 5 is just when you begin to understand life and death. You're first introduced to it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in that respect, with our older son, we could have done more to prepare him. But he's doing well, and you know, I hate to second guess at this point, but it was hard. It was hard enough to think about it ourselves. Never mind think about how you prepare your children.
Tell me about Alex. She was 6 when she died. Yes,
she was 8.
8.
Yes.
What did she know, and how did she die?
Well, she died because her cancer took over her body.
No, I mean how psychologically.
She, you know, I tried to talk about it with her in the last months of her life, and she made it pretty clear that she understood what was going on, and she really did not want to talk about it. There was no point in talking about it, and that was okay. She just wanted to live. And we followed her lead in that respect. She really put a lot of focus into her lemonade stand and making sure it was going to continue without her. At the end of her life, she knew, and I don't like to assume that I know it was in her head. She acted as if she had a certain purpose that she wanted to fulfill, which was her goal of raising $1 million. And that once she achieved that, she was okay. She was okay.
You've been talking about this and Alex for a long time in many venues. Can you say how you are right now, how you're feeling?
Well, I think, life still goes up and down. The past few days have not been good for me, good days, which usually just means in my head it's not a good day. I don't generally change my behavior. I try not to.
Can you say what that means, not good days?
A lot of thinking of Alex, which I do anyways, but in a more hurtful way for myself, in terms of if she was here, you know, I could be buying her Christmas gifts. What would she be like? She'd be turning 14 next month. Just a lot of thoughts of how unfair it is that she's not here.
I have a question. In the midst of all this pain these last few days, do you feel closer to her?
That's the irony of it. It's when I'm thinking and letting myself feel closer to her that is much more painful than just getting up and going through your day and not really, you know, letting those feelings come through. So I think, honestly, I go through it periodically, and I think it's a survival mechanism. I have to do it. And to not feel close to her and to not miss her wouldn't feel right to me
as a mom. Yeah, I ask anybody who's lost a loved one, would you, if there was a magic pill or magic therapy, would you like to be without the pain? And nobody says yes.
Right, because the pain represents the love.
Right, where they are, right, mm-hmm. Right. Where is she now for you in your mind and your belief system?
I struggle with that. I was raised very Catholic, and through the years, certainly not religious, but have a lot of faith in the fact that her spirit lives on, and that gives me a lot of comfort. I don't know that I have, you know, a vision of her with angel wings and, you know, and what we would think of as heaven, but she lives on, her spirit lives on, without a doubt in my mind. And obviously that brings me a great deal of comfort to think that she knows what's going on.
You have got to give us a brief review of the lemonade stand?
I'd love to.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Well, Alex raised about $1 million, and that was a goal of hers. And as I said, she reached that goal and died not 2 weeks later. So clearly, she was hanging on. And because of what she did at the end of her life, it's continued, and it's flourished, and it's grown. And now it's much more fair to say it's because of the generosity of other people who have heard the story or have had their own loved ones with cancer or even just overcoming adversity, and it resonates with them, and they get involved. And now we've raised over $30 million. We've funded over 100 projects all across the country. We've made some breakthroughs. We are really doing what she set out to do, which is to make a difference for kids with cancer.
$30 million. So let me ask you, if I get a taste for lemonade, where do I go? Do I go online?
You go online, alexslemonade.org, or if you just search for Alex's Lemonade Stand, it's all over the place. And you can learn about Alex. You can read more about her life. You can learn about how to hold a stand. You can just be inspired by some of the things other people are doing.
Hmm. Let me ask, turn to Froma for a quick question before our break. When we were hearing from Liz, it seems almost as though the family was taking their cues from Alex, that she was really in charge right from the beginning. We think of family support, we often think the opposite of the family taking charge of things. Yeah. But here, Alex was in charge.
It's so interesting. It's not uncommon that a child with a life-threatening illness has such an appreciation and a deep understanding and wisdom about not only their life, but what matters in life, and that she really taught the family to make the most of the time they had.
Yeah, it's really amazing and unusual. And I promised Gita Simons, my producer, I'd go to break, but I got to renege on that promise for just one last question before we go. Liz, has Alex's life and death changed your relationship with the boys, your image of what life means? What life means?
Has it changed my relationship, you mean, as a parent to my sons?
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I think her wisdom and the way she taught us to live our lives has changed all of our lives, but certainly I, you know, from little things like getting less annoyed, maybe at certain annoyances kids can, you know, bring into your life, to bigger things like really, really just knowing that they're going to be okay, and that children are pretty incredible with their dreams, and
it's,
if you just give them the tools to get there.
It's that faith thing. You have faith in your children and in their resilience. And you say you're less reactive, you're more laid back, you're more tolerant?
I'm more tolerant. I mean, I have certain things, like all parents, that I won't tolerate, but at big picture stuff, I will tolerate their little things that aren't significant in life. I just want them to be good people and to grow up happy and to hopefully live their dreams, whatever they are.
Hey, Liz, will you be my mommy? I mean, never mind. Scratch that. Too many psychologists listen to this show. I don't know where that's going to go. As promised, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with all our guests, and we'll be talking with our very patient callers who've been holding on for a very long time. We're talking about the resilience of the human spirit. I was just talking with Liz Scott, who, along with her husband, run Alex's Lemonade Stand. It's was started by her daughter Alexandra, who wanted to raise money and to help children who have cancer. It's raised $3 million. We'll also be talking again with Rob and Robbie Wonder. Robbie is a quadriplegic. He goes to Temple. His father gave up his career, and he also goes to Temple with Robbie, helping him get started and get through his day there. And I'm also joined by Froma Walsh. She's a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, author of Strengthening Family Resilience. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Singers with an All-American Christmas program around the theme of the shepherds. I'm Ed Cunningham. Join me for Christmas on Logan Square from WHYY in Philadelphia and PRI, Public Radio International. Thursday night at 10 on WHYY.
Washington Post humor columnist Gene Weingarten says you should have one goal at this year's Christmas party. Get out as soon as you can.
There is nothing like a party to create these little knots of small talk where people are constantly straining to be funny and interesting, and it just makes me want to flee.
Surviving holiday parties, if you're lucky enough to have one, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the resilience of the spirit with Froma Walsh, a clinical psychologist, author of Strengthening Family Resilience. Rob and Robbie Wonder. Robbie became a quadriplegic 3 years ago, and his father, Rob, gave up his career to help his son get through college. And Liz Scott. Liz and her husband lost their daughter, Alex, to cancer 5 years ago, but before she died, Alex wanted to start a lemonade stand to help raise money to help doctors cure kids with cancer, and that was the beginning of Alex's lemonade stand. So let's go right to the callers. We've got Matthew on the line. Matthew, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on. I think resiliency can really aid you existentially. Resiliency has been critically important in my life, first as a person who was born with a disability, and now as a therapist at the Council for Relationships. Just to give you listeners an idea, I was born without arms, but with small hands at my shoulders. I have legs, but I was born without knees or ankles, and I had to have at least one major surgery every year from 2 until 16, and many since. I've had constant pain for 22 years, and I have PTSD, but I have a happy life, and I've been successful, and it's been because of the support of my family, because of role models like you who can prove that you can be successful as a therapist with a disability, and then having the outlet of being able to use the tough experiences of my life to help a wide array of people, and with people with pain and disabilities and their family. My experience gives me a unique clinical perspective that my clients have really
clarify something. Well, first of all, you said something early on. You said that this kind of trauma ages one existentially.
Yes.
What does that mean? You sound like young guy. You don't have wrinkles and stuff.
No, I'm 32. But, you know, I've had to deal with loss of function. I've had to deal with being different. I've had to deal with a lot of different things that most young people don't have to deal with.
So you're wiser than an average 32-year-old.
I think I have a broader perspective in ways, yes.
Yeah.
And so many people have helped me in my life that for me, the really central tenet of my life is to help others. And so I think that's the ultimate goal, I think, of being resilient is using the difficult things in your life as a positive to help others.
I think you might be right on target. I want to turn to Froma because you touched on a few very important things. And thanks so much for your call, Matthew. So he talked about giving to others as an important issue.
That's right. There's something about suffering that opens our heart, opens our spirit into compassion for the suffering of others. And earlier we talked about hope and what we hope for. And sometimes when maybe we can't change our own situation, we are able to rise above that or transcend that to see what can we do that can help others who are suffering. It might be through a career ourselves.
To help others in nursing or medicine or therapy. It might be through advocacy or social action or community service. And through helping others, it also enlarges our heart and our ability to heal and move on.
And of course, that's the case whether we've endured trauma or not. Liz, that's what your life is about. And I guess that has helped you heal. You were given the gift by Alex of knowing what she wanted, what kind of legacy she wanted.
I think every day that I'm very lucky to have the work with Alex's Lemonade Stand, that get to meet the most generous, wonderful people. And yes, it was a gift from Alex, and I've always believed that she knew she was setting me up to be okay and to have something positive to focus on in addition to the boys.
I want to change the subject just a bit from at the risk of this sounding too much like Pollyannish to some
people.
I'm
glad you're doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who get stuck, and even we heard earlier from Matthew. I mean, he had PTSD.
Right.
He said PTSD. So a lot of people get stuck, and I hate that strong, weak continuum. I just hate it.
Exactly.
So,
I think a misunderstanding of resilience is a stiff upper lip or keep cheerful all the time, just put one foot in front of the other, when really it is a roller coaster and it is about navigating through very rough times. For instance, holidays, the times when you see other children the same age as your child moving forward, that remind you of the loss of your hopes and dreams as well as the loss of your child, and that there is suffering and struggle. And then there's also that reaching down deep within oneself and reaching out to others that enables us to, again, move forward and rise above it.
Robbie, do you consider yourself resilient?
Yeah, I guess so. I never really thought about it before, but I guess I'm pretty resilient.
Rob, how about you?
I would say I'm resilient.
And Liz?
Sometimes. I mean, I think it is important for people to know that it's not a straight line up. You're getting better and better and better. It's some days are better than others. Some weeks are better than others. I feel like some years are better than others. So, yes, sometimes I feel resilient. I would never really call myself that because I feel like I would have a breaking point at some point where something just came my way that I thought, I'm not sure I can do this. And hopefully at that time I would find that inner strength or find it in other people and eventually find that inner strength to say, okay, I don't have a choice. I have to deal with this. But
yeah, I mean, the answer is always for today.
Exactly.
For today. I think one lesson we all learn is that, all of this stuff comes out of the clear blue. I mean, very few trauma is predictable, and it tells us something about life, is that for today. I want to ask you from about the importance of social networks. It's a problem in our culture because there are fewer social networks and we rely on them less. But they can be
in some ways, yes. But I think the internet has opened so many possibilities, not just social networking, but information about different illnesses or situations, the ability to link with associations that can provide support.
I wonder about the issue of faith that we alluded to earlier. What role does that play, and how do people get through who don't have faith?
Well, faith means different things to different people. Surveys find that it may be that we don't go to worship services, or maybe many aren't as active in congregations, but it's a more personal way of finding spiritual nourishment, meaning in our lives. It could be through our existential values. It could be through a relationship with God. So it's really how each of us tap into a soulful place within ourselves and in our relationships with others.
Yeah, I think about the issue of prayer, and everything I know about prayer involves knees bent, head bowed, a quality of humility. And whoever or whatever we pray to is always bigger than us, which makes us small, a small part of the larger universe. And, you know, that's about faith. It's about letting go. It's about letting go of yesterday. It's about letting go of our egos. It's about letting go and just having faith. It's not necessarily about a higher power. And that's where we find serenity. Of course, that's easy to define, and it takes a lifetime at least to get there.
But could I say it's not just letting go? It's also about connection, feeling connection to spiritual energy or mm-hmm. higher power, or to the human community, or to all life.
I think that's a great point, and it's a great point to end on. I want to thank all my guests so much for joining us. Froma Walsh is a psychologist, a professor at University of Chicago. She's written Strengthening Family Resilience. We heard from Rob and Robbie Wunder. Robbie became a quadriplegic as a result of a diving accident. His father gave up his career to help Robbie get through college. And we were joined here in the studio by Liz Scott. Liz and her husband lost their daughter, Alex, to cancer, and as a result of her vision, they have started Alex's Lemonade Stand. You can find them at alexslemonade.org. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be discussing the year in review in mental health. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.